Ladies and gentlemen, I think we will get started. I want to welcome all of you who are here in person and those of you who are virtually to our ACB annual legislative seminar. My name is Debbie Grubb, and it seems like since I was born, I have been the ACB governmental affairs chair, but I'm proud to do it. And we have our first Zoom guest is here. I am very hopeful that the second one arrives. But what we're going to do, we've got a big agenda, so we're going to get started. And I am so proud to call on our new governmental relations specialist, head of everything, Claire Stanley. She is back with us, and I have a feeling when I looked at the email, there were more messages applauding the fact that Claire is back with us than I've seen on any subject in a long time. So Claire has several things to talk with us about. So without any further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Claire. Claire, welcome to our legislative seminar.
Thank you so much, Debbie. It's great to be here. And just a quick comment, I do believe the other speaker logged in. So just so you know, Debbie. But thank you so much. It's great to be here with you guys. I wish I was there in person, but regardless, it's great to be here with you guys, even virtually. And I like that Debbie says that I know everything. I wish that was true, but that's wonderful. So I was asked to speak with you guys a little bit about what advocacy is, how it works, when to advocate, how to advocate, at what level, just a little bit of everything. So I'm going to go through my notes based on the kind of questions I had, and as I was given by your leaders. And as I was going through these, it was kind of fun because, to tell you the truth, this is actually a little bit of what Swath and I have been preparing for the what we call advocacy boot camp for the convention this summer in Jacksonville. So a little bit of a teaser. Hopefully you guys are coming back to Florida this summer for the ACB National Convention. So if you want to continue to talk about these issues, that is what we will be doing with Swatha and myself at the boot camp. So I was given a few questions, and some of them kind of bleed together. So I'm going to read some of the questions, but just kind of talk in general. So the first question or topic I was asked is, trying to read my Braille notes at the same time. Okay, determine how an issue is brought forth by the membership group. And so we all know in the blindness community or the disability community, we face a lot of issues. So how do we decide what to advocate for? Because honestly, if we were to advocate for everything that we need access to or discrimination that we face, we would be working 24/7. There's just a lot of issues that we could be working on. And I wish we had the bandwidth and the resources to work on everything. But again, it's just a lot. So how do we decide what we're working on? So one thing I wrote in my notes is looking for issues that impact the largest group of people. So we obviously, because we have limited resources, we want to acknowledge things that are going to impact kind of the bigger population, you know, so we use our resources wisely. And so one thing I put in my notes is you probably see a lot of surveys that come through from the national office that say, who's facing X issue? Because we want to know what's really impacting the largest group of people. So that, again, we're going to spend our resources wisely, we're going to use them wisely. It's not that we shouldn't work on individual issues. That's definitely important. And we hope you guys are advocating for yourselves. But again, just when we're doing advocacy, especially at the state or federal level, we really have to be thinking broadly so that we use our time, our resources, our money, those kinds of things wisely. We also want to think about what's really timely. Sometimes there might be an issue that we're really passionate about, let's say some kind of digital access, but we know that it might not be around for much longer. You know, technology is constantly changing. So we want to make sure that the thing we are advocating for is timely and relevant, because it'd be great if we have something we're passionate about. But if we advocate for it today and tomorrow it's gone, again, it's really a game of resources and using our resources widely. So we want things to remain relevant. We also, kind of related to that, we want to think about precedents. So precedence, if you're not familiar with that term, is how, especially in the United States, through the legal system, but not just the legal system, but especially through the legal system, if a court decides something, even though it's on one issue, it can then be used to apply to other similar issues. So we want to think about issues we're dealing with that might be, let's say, impactful for one school district in Florida, but then could be used for that same advocacy for a case in Alabama. So we want to think about advocacy that's going to have an even bigger forward-looking impact on a greater population of people. So that's kind of just a little bit of overview about the ways we can think about what issues we work on. That's definitely not covering everything. There's always other ways we can think about it, but that's just kind of a brief overview. So then to kind of build off of that, I was asked, when we're advocating things for things, do we look at the city level, the county, the state, the federal? Which approach do we take? And so my first answer is going to be everything. But I know you're thinking, well, okay, that's a great answer, but no, seriously, what is the answer? So I'll talk a little bit about some of the answers. So first, you should know what governs the issue at hand. So, for instance, a lot of times we talk about issues that impact our community, and we instantly go to the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is a federal law. So, if you're going to bring a case, you're either going to bring it at the state or federal court level. But know what the laws are in your own state. Maybe you have something, a municipal policy or something else. So know your laws and that kind of thing. But also know where the issue really is. You guys have probably heard the saying, so to speak, that all politics is local. So I think a lot of times we're eager beavers to immediately go to the Supreme Court to make change. But a lot of times changing things at the local level really is the best. It's where we have the most power, the most leverage, the best relationships. And so know where you're going to be the most successful. Again, we're a country where precedence is a big thing. So if you start at the local level, it really can build up. So know that. Again, know how policy works. When we're talking about voting, a big issue we all like to talk about, right? It's important for us. We often think we need to run to the federal courts to change policy for voting, which we do. There are federal policies, but the way voting policies are implemented is at the county level. So if you're actually trying to make change for voting, you don't necessarily need to go directly to Congress. You should actually be talking to your county leaders about how they're implementing these policies, because they're the ones boots on the ground deciding which voting devices to purchase and how they're going to implement it. So again, really knowing how things are governed within your community. When you're dealing with legislators, going to city versus county versus state can also depend on what relationships you have. Having relationships is so important. So let's say Debbie has some awesome relationship with somebody right there in this Florida legislature. That's great. And that might influence where you go. So sometimes it's just who you know and how you can work with people. So be really cognizant about that, because that's really important. This is kind of going to bleed into the next answer, but not just if you're going to the state or local or federal level, but also just the vehicle you're using. Our country has three branches of our government: the legislative, judicial, and executive. And again, this is kind of a sneak peek of our boot camp this summer. But the question here for advocacy is, should we sue or should we go and try to create law? Obviously, we should know what exists already, but also just thinking about what's going to have the biggest impact, also what's going to be the most affordable, what's going to be the quickest. Sometimes changing things at the federal level is impractical. I know one issue we're all really passionate about, understandably, is improving paratransit. It's antiquated, it doesn't provide the services we need. But to be perfectly honest, if we want to change it at the federal level, it's going to be a much harder slog. We'll try, I promise, in the ACB national office, we'll try. But if you want to try to make changes to paratransit, doing it at the local county level is probably going to be quicker and at least more immediate. So the third question, third out of the fourth that I was asked, which kind of bleeds into what I've been talking about, is would work best. Again, looking at the three different or the multiple levels at city, county, state, and federal, and the judicial versus legislative, etc. First of all, again, like I said, with the levels, there is no right answer. it depends on the issue. And honestly, you guys, sometimes one of my personal advocacy philosophy is you throw the spaghetti at the wall and you see what sticks. Sometimes you might do a little bit of both at the same time. I know of Illinois, they have been working really hard on electronic ballot return work. And they've really worked hard at creating legislation, but now they haven't had the greatest response. Sorry, state of Illinois, we're rooting for you. So they're talking about doing things more through social media. They've thought, do they need to sue? They've, you know, talked to attorneys. So sometimes you got to take multiple approaches. So I encourage the multi-pronged approach, which can be both through the government and through social media. Think about the things we were just talking about, city versus state. It all has different ways of doing things, again, where our relationships are. What does it cost? You know, ACB, the national office, we want to do a lot of advocacy, but we are a small nonprofit. You know, we have some great relationships with attorneys, but again, things really cost a lot of money. So sometimes when we're advocating, we have to think about what our bandwidth is, even in the financial components. If you had access to attorneys who are willing to help, go for it, use it, access it. Finding groups to collaborate with. Like I was just talking about that advocacy for voting in Illinois. They're working with local NFB chapters, with Centers for Independent Living, with the Illinois Protection and Advocacy Office. That's huge. Work in groups. Because again, we all have limited resources, and when we bring them together, that's even better. And then the last question I was asked, hopefully I'm not going, nope, I think I'm right on the time I was given. So the last question I was asked are, meaningful tools you can use for advocacy. And again, I think I've kind of already been alluding to some of these, but I'm going to mention them again. Collaboration. I truly believe one of the best tools we have as advocates is to work with others, whether that be cross disability, so with people, advocacy groups of other disabilities that aren't just blindness, as well as other blindness orgs. So I just talked about the protection and advocacy offices. In Florida, it's Disability Rights Florida. They do some great work. There's a lot of attorneys there, but also working with your Centers for Independent Living, with the NFB chapter of the state. Again, collaboration is huge because, again, if only we all had the money in the world and the time in the world and the resources, but we don't. Also, like I said, I'm a firm believer in throwing the spaghetti at the wall. So use whatever. You don't just necessarily try one approach. Use the different state and federal government complaint processes that are out there. Are they going to work tomorrow? No, probably not. I'm going to be a realist. But does that mean that we shouldn't do them? No, please do them, because the more we make noise about discrimination, the better. So for instance, file complaints with the Disability Rights section of the Department of Justice. You can go to ada.gov and file it. I've heard people say, well, I'm not going to do that because I've done it before and it takes months or even years. I get it. It's frustrating. But if we don't do that, the Department of Justice isn't hearing that we want these issues to be dealt with. Know that in your states, a lot of states have their own human rights programs that do similar things. Again, go into it knowing and being realistic that it might not be fixed overnight, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. Same thing with filing with companies. Uber and Lyft with service animal denials. People say they've given up filing those complaints because nothing happens. I get it. I get irritated myself because I have to do it all the time, but it doesn't mean we shouldn't be doing it because, again, if we keep talking over and over again, hopefully, I think something's going to happen eventually. So patience is one of the biggest tools we should have in our toolkit when we're advocating. But again, using all types of resources, that collaborating with other groups, filing with different federal or state or local agencies, things like that. We've been talking a lot about what we can do through the different governmental systems. That's not the only thing we've got out there. Social media, you guys. We live in an era, where everything can be put online. Let's make a statement. I don't know if you guys remember, maybe about 10 years ago, they did the ice bucket challenge for ALS research. It was all over social media, and the ALS community got a lot of money out of that. You know, how was effective was it? I don't know, but I think a lot more people know about ALS. So use social media. Write letters. Again, you can do it to the local level, the state level. One thing we've talked about a lot in the advocacy world when it comes to legislature, whether it's at the state or federal level, is that if they meaning the offices, receive the same letters from, let's say, 100 people all at the same time, they're more likely to sit up in their chair than if they just get one. So, like you guys know, we do a lot of programs where we'll give you guys pre-written letters and say, send them, go. I know Illinois, again, with the voting, is thinking about doing that. So think about how you can do letter or telephone call-in campaigns. There's a switchboard for the federal government that you can call into. I'm sure there's the same for the Florida legislature. So just, keep that in mind. With that, when you are talking to the legislature, give your stories. Those of us who work here in DC, we can talk all day about the statistics and the facts. But when you guys give your own lived experiences about how, for instance, you waited on paratransit for 3 hours and got to work 2 hours late, that is far more impactful. So tell the legislature your own stories. They want to hear that, and I think that's going to make a much bigger impact. So that is what I had. I hope I didn't rush through it too quickly, but I just wanted to give an overview of, again, the different branches of the government at the different levels, and the resources outside that we can use that aren't just necessarily using the government to advocate. And also, lastly, about how we can work together, not just with ACB or our state affiliates, but with as many organizations as we can. So I can take questions when or if we have time, but thank you so much, Debbie.
Thank you, Claire. And don't go anywhere because we're going to take your, they want to clap for you. So clap for Claire. Go for it. There you go. Claire, I think we're going to take questions from you now. And I have one more little surprise thing for you to do. So don't go anywhere after the questions. But let's go ahead while this is fresh in our minds. I'm thinking about finding out if we can't get Claire's remarks transcribed. Anyway, but that's for another day. But any questions? We have our mic runner, right?
Stacia's standing by with the mic, so if anybody has a question.
So if you have a question, please raise your hand.
We got a hand up.
All right, go for it.
Hold on, going to Scott over here. Hold on one second.
Okay.
Hi, Claire. This is Scott Thornhill. Thank you for your presentation.
You're welcome, Scott.
I have one question. So how do you start, for example, like, you reach out to someone, whether it's local or it's whatever, oftentimes you get a gatekeeper, so to speak, or they won't get you, you can't get to the person you need to get to. So how do you handle it in a case like that? You want to be persistent without being obnoxious. What's your process for that?
That is a great question. And you just answered part of what I was going to say
I'm glad
was
that you appreciate
to
my
be
question.
Persistent, but not obnoxious. But I really think persistence is the key. Just to continue to make those phone calls, continue to make those emails, send those emails. Sometimes, like you said, you do have the gatekeeper. So trying to get creative about how to get in, just calling the front 1-800 phone number might not, hopefully, but might not get you in. So then kind of brainstorming, do I go on LinkedIn and try to find someone else who works there? Our communities, especially in Washington, D.C., are pretty small. So do you kind of do your research to find someone who has worked with them before? But trying to get creative on how you can get in the front door, because like you said, sometimes it's hard. But I am a big believer in persistence. You can wear them down eventually. So yeah, just be persistent and be creative about how you get your foot in the front door.
And another thing that we all can do, and most of us do it when we go to Capitol Hill, making relationships with people who have access to the people is very important. If you go in
absolutely
and you got a document and you say, would you please mark this up, and they're going to do it because they know you. I don't know about Claire, but sometimes when you see a member, it's very successful, and sometimes they want a photo op. You sit down with a member, with a staff, a legislative assistant or staffer, sometimes you get more time, and then they go and make, so that is another thing to think about, I think.
Absolutely. And to build off of what Debbie was saying with the relationships, continue those relationships. Mr. Scott Thornhill. He and I just had some conversations with our Virginia representatives because we want to keep that relationship since that's where the national office is. And you know, the first time you talk to them, even the second or third time you talk to them, it might not be on a very specific topic or have some, you know, amazing outcome, but you're building that relationship so that in a year from now, after we've met with them for a few times, and then we have a very specific ask, we can say, hey, remember us? So keeping and building and sustaining those relationships is really helpful and important.
Thank you, Claire. Any other questions here or in Zoom?
We have one right here. It's Russ. Hang on a second.
Okay.
Thank you, Debbie. Thank you, Claire. This is Russ Davis from the National Federation of the Blind. Whew, nobody booed. Okay, that's always good to hear. I wanted just to chat with you for a minute, and you and Debbie both have pretty much said everything I was going to say. Debbie, I'll think of something else. But what I wanted to get a real quick response from you on, Claire, is the partnership that the ACB and the NFB have when it comes to not every legislative priority or issue, but certainly more than we used to. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on how you collaborate directly with, for example, the Federation in Baltimore. I know that Clark was doing a lot of that before. It was exciting when I heard that. And I'm curious to see if you want to kind of enlighten us on how that's working.
Absolutely. That's a great question. So we actually currently meet on a weekly basis every single week with both NFB and then a couple other national orgs like AFB and NDRN to work on the website access work that we're doing. Our main goal at first and still is to get the website and Software Accessibility Act passed, but it's now morphed into everything related to that. So for instance, we worked on the comments for the DOJ Title II website regulations. So literally every week, like clockwork, we all get together. And I think it's great because, like I've said, and like you alluded to, working together is so powerful because you've got more heads in the game, more, you know, hands in the game. So that's been really great. I know we compared for our, we call our leadership conference. I apologize. I forget what NFB calls their January meeting, but we compared our legislative imperatives this year. And I believe it was two, maybe even three of them were the same this year. So it really does show that we have a lot of the same goals. So I think it's great that, and like you said, we're maybe not always going to have the same priorities, and that's okay. But that when we do, being able to get ourselves together, you know, Baltimore is not far from Alexandria and DC is right in the middle. So when we can work on these issues together.
This is Stacia. I actually have a question. I have my hand up just for myself. I have a question. For those of you guys who don't know me, I am sighted. And we do a lot of advocacy in our little organization. What are some best practices and good advice that you guys have working for how to get sighted people to be better advocates beyond and in addition to making sure that you have a member of the community on your advocacy team or more than one member of the community? What are some best practices that the sighted folks can use to be able to help and to be encouraged, behaviors to be encouraged, et cetera?
Ooh, that's a wonderful question. I feel like we could talk about this for a while. And first of all, thank you so much for your involvement and your participation. I think for me, the biggest thing that first needs to be done when we have allies in the community is just making sure that the allies understand our issues from our perspective. I truly believe that most non-disabled people aren't malicious, but if you're not part of a people group, you might not understand how we think and what our goals are, the way we want to deal with those goals. You know, if you're not blind, you might think, you know, not putting words in your mouth at all, but you might think, just an assumption, oh, people want to suddenly have their vision back. And that's not true for everybody. I'm not making a general statement, but everybody is different. So really talking to the people and understanding where they're coming from, what their goals are, what their priorities are, what their thinking philosophy is. Because again, for instance, you guys can't see me. My camera's not on and we're blind and low vision for the most part. But I am a white person. I'm Caucasian. And so if I was to suddenly go into a group of African Americans, I would never assume what their interests and goals and strategies and philosophies are, because that would be so awful of me because I'm not part of that people group. So I would want to learn from them how they think, what their philosophies are. So I think it has very similar overlays in that respect, to really understand how a people group thinks and what their philosophies are and what their strategies are, if that makes sense.
It does. Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, Claire.
Wait, we have a hand up on the floor. Hang on, it's coming to Alicia. Hold on a second.
Hi, I'm Alicia, and I just am curious about something you mentioned earlier, the summer boot camp. Could you tell us about that and, like, who qualifies and what is it and what
yes.
is it and all those things?
Yep, it is a session at annual convention. If you guys have access to the internet, the schedule is up. I should know which day it is, but I don't remember. I do not, if I say this wrong, Larry or someone can slap me on the wrist, but I think it might be a hybrid event. So you can participate whether you're there in person or virtually. It's just an hour and 15 minute session like most of the sessions, but it's just one of the many fun events we have at annual convention this summer.
Claire, please stay put because there's one more thing I want you to be involved in, but I'm going to take a moment and ask our Zoom people, has Kevin Alkenberg come yet?
Yes, he is here.
All right, then I am going to happily and proudly, and Claire, please do stay put, sweetie. We talked briefly about relationships with legislative assistants, and this year, it wasn't easy, but we got it done. Russ tried, I tried, but we got it done. So anyway, we have a wonderful legislative assistant with us from the office of Representative John Rutherford, who is the representative in this general area. And we like, whenever possible, to have a representative from the area in which our convention is being held. And I asked him to become a teacher this afternoon. Many times people say, but I don't know what to do to prepare for a meeting, and I don't know if people are paying attention, and I feel uncomfortable, and I feel unqualified. And so I asked Kevin today to speak with us a bit about what people like he is want from us when we come to a meeting. What grabs his attention? What information is the most helpful? What kinds of things can we say to kind of cause a member to say, yeah? Because what we have to remember is these people see people who are passionate about issues all day long. So what makes us stand out? How can we make best use of a very short time that we have to meet with these people to hopefully come up with the best outcome? So with that long introduction, I happily introduce you to Kevin Alkenberg, legislative assistant on the John Rutherford team.
Hello, everyone. Well, thank you all so much for having me. Great to hear, you know, you guys are hosting us down in Jacksonville, which is a part of Congressman Rutherford's district. So welcome. Claire, a fantastic presentation. Just wanted to touch on two quick points that she brought up that I wanted to kind of affirm. One, about, you know, the letters that you folks do send to our office. Those are very important. Those all do get read and they do get responded to. And us, you know, legislative staffers, we do take note on the amount they come in, how many people requesting, what they're requesting, what bills related to that, and how best to respond. So do keep up doing that. And the other thing is, yes, you know, the importance of kind of the three levels of government, local, state, and federal. Because sometimes even here on Capitol Hill, we get caught up, right, on, well, federally, what can we do? What can we do? When sometimes the best answer may be at that state level or maybe at that local level where you can find kind of quicker solutions instead of trying to, you know, take federal action. Of course, there is a lot of federal nexus, a lot of pieces of legislation with the federal nexus. So I'm going to kind of break down kind of into three parts as far as when you're preparing to meet with a member or a staffer, you know, some things to do during the meeting that are helpful, and as well as following up after the meeting. And then I'll go ahead and open it up to questions. So first off, something that, we always find useful, especially when you're meeting either with a member or a staffer, doing a little background on the member's district or even the member's biography, their background, to try to find a connection as far as, what you're coming, let's say if you have the Access to Technology Affordability Act. It's my understanding that is a Ways and Means bill, right? Does the member sit on Ways and Means, right? Because that's a connection. I know for our office here, for Congressman Rutherford, in our district down in St. Augustine is the Florida School for the Deaf and the Blind, right? So that's a strong connection for our office when it comes to accessibility issues, right? So that's something to try to keep in mind when you come, you talk to a staffer. That's one way to connect quickly the issue you're bringing to their attention, and as well as an issue that, why is it specifically important that their office listens and tries to work with you to get done what needs to be done. You also want to think of, what is your ask? You want to try to make that clear. Staffers and members both may be taking 6-7 meetings a day, right? So we take a lot of meetings, and what we do is we kind of process requests, we do research. And then if you're not meeting with a member, if you're meeting with a staffer, right, we do that research, and then we bring it to the member. So what helps us is if there's a clear ask, which I think if, the groups I've met with, Florida Federation of the Blind, Florida Council of the Blind, you guys have always been very good at bringing specific requests to our attention. Which once again, that makes it very helpful. So, the request is the co-sponsor, the Medical Devices Non-Visual Accessibility Act. The request is to sign on to this letter. That gives us staffers clear direction on what we need to look at in order to bring it to the member's attention. Or if you're speaking with the member, it lets the member know, this is what we need. This is how you can help. And it boils it down very easily. The other thing I always suggest is if you guys have information, one pagers are always helpful. But if you guys have information to send electronically in advance, that also makes it helpful, especially when you're meeting with a member. That allows us staff to take a look at what you all are requesting and prepare some notes for the member. So that way they are also better prepared for when they take that meeting. So one, so they can ask questions, so they're better aware on the front end of what your request is. And it also gives them the possibility that maybe they're able, to take a look at the bill beforehand, and maybe you can get them to a yes right there in the meeting. That doesn't always happen. Usually the yes comes after the meeting. But sometimes that happens. So anytime, you all have, electronic, information, you can email it over to, usually it's the scheduler, to say, these are, a few paragraphs, this is a couple bills we're taking a look at. That helps the staff, that helps the member, and that will help, you all once you get to the meeting. Now, during the meeting, both with staff and member, of course, you want to do introductions, right? I'd always say, prioritize constituents, right? Usually you visit a member's office in groups. If there's a constituent there, sometimes you may want to let them take the lead, right? Because they are the voter to the representative. They're in your district. That is their, representative at the federal level. And definitely introduce yourselves and definitely share your story. That's something that Claire brought up. And that's really almost the more important part, right? Like, of course, we want to hear information on the bill. We want to know what the bill does. But a lot of, the staff work we'll do is on that back end of the specifics. What does the committee think about it? Who are the co-sponsors? And that's all good information to have. But sharing that story is what makes that personal connection and what flags it for the staff and for the member as far as, this is an important issue. If you have, someone who is blind and cannot access a piece of medical equipment, that's a major issue, right? And so sharing a story like that, shows why there needs to be action done at the federal level. So always prioritize, trying to share your story. Going back to a clear ask is always important. If you have a bill you're trying to get signed a co-sponsor for, if you have a letter, if it's an appropriations request, you know, let them know that. And always be there to educate, you know. You don't want to be confrontational. You know, staff take a lot of meetings, right? So try to educate them. And another thing is, especially when you're meeting with staff and as well as members, right? Most staff have a pretty broad portfolio. Congressman Rutherford, I think we have about 13 staff. Only four or five of us really deal with specific legislation, right? So we all have pretty large areas that we cover. So a lot of staff may need, you know, some background information, or they may need to do some research on both the front and the back end to truly understand your issue, right? If you have three bills you're bringing, you may be an expert already on those bills, but the staffer may not know about, you know, the tax credit you all are looking for, right? They may not know about how the FDA approval process works for medical devices, right? So that is something always to keep in mind. Taking a look at my notes here. So some other good information. Once again, if you have the time on the front end to take a research, you know, who's leading the piece of legislation, we always find that helpful, especially if it's someone that, you know, we may know, maybe it's an office we work closely with, maybe it's a member on that committee, which is always helpful when you have a member leading a bill on the committee of jurisdiction. That makes the path a little more clear for trying to get to a markup in the future. You know, what kind of co-sponsors does it have? Is it bipartisan? You know, is there other members of the Florida delegation on it, right? And as well as what other organizations support, you know, does this affect a wider range of folks? Is also important are some things that, you know, staff will take note of. And then finally, after the meeting, you know, I always suggest sending, you know, it can just be an email follow-up thank you to the staffer, or to the staffer, you know, address to the member if you didn't meet with the member. That is always helpful. But one thing I always, you know, let people know is that, especially when you're meeting with staff, and if you don't get an answer from the congressman immediately, right, the staff is going to need to do work in order to take a look at the bill, to run it up the chain. Often there's an internal process. You know, they may reach out to the committee. You know, they may do further research on it. So usually it may take, you know, a couple weeks for them to try to get back to you with an answer. So my suggestion, in order to try to keep it top of mind, right, is maybe a day or two after you reach out with that thank you, but then give it a week or two until you follow up with a, hey, you know, thank you so much for meeting with us again. Wanted to circle back, you know, see if they have any questions, see if they have any concerns. Because that way it kind of keeps it at the top of their inbox, keeps it at the top of their mind. Because even just getting time to sit down with the member, like as staff, to go over, you know, bills, even that, you know, I know we had a busy week here in our office. I didn't get a chance to go over, you know, a list of things with my boss, right? So that's another week gets delayed. So it does take some time, you know, internally for offices to process that. So I always suggest, once again, spacing in that second kind of follow-up on your specific ask for about 2 weeks. And then don't be afraid, you know, to keep up with them. You know, every month, don't hesitate to check in. You know, if the bill moves along, let's say it gets marked up or it gets a certain more co-sponsors, don't hesitate to follow up and, hey, just wanted to see, you know, if you all would reconsider this request. You know, I think that's usually a good way, trying to balance keeping it at the top of their inbox, letting them know it's an issue that you're passionate about, that people back in the district care about, without, you know, sending them an email every day or without getting confrontational, I think is the important part. And so with that, you know, I'll kind of open up the questions. I'd love to hear what questions you all have as far as, you know, when you guys do come to DC, if you guys would like some kind of, you know, inside knowledge on, you know, how things work, happy to answer to the best of my abilities.
Okay. This is great. And let's give Kevin a hand. He turned into a very good professor. Okay. Let's see I will say this. When he was talking about some of the things we do, ACB leads us by example. When we go on Capitol Hill, we have the one pager, we have all the information about who's doing what. And so we need to replicate that when we do advocacy on a state and local level. So are there any hands raised with questions for Professor Auchenberg?
At this moment, no hands raised on the floor out here.
Any on
Wait,
Zoom?
I take it back. We've got two hands raised. Russ, you're next. I'm starting down here in the front left, front right. Here you go.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Anisio Correa. You're from Florida. My question to the professor is, considering that we are now, hopefully, out of the pandemic and all the restrictions that he brought with it, how are you seeing people coming to your office? Whether are they coming in person, people still doing Zoom meetings? And do you have any preference at all, or do you think that is one is more effective than the other?
That's a great question. And I will say this may depend on staff, on office level, right? Of course, it's always great when folks come up to DC, you know, be able to see them in person. That is great. But we also understand that sometimes, for time constraints or for other constraints, right, it is easier to do Zoom. So I know for me personally, I'm flexible to do either. Usually my kind of thing is if it's an in-session day, you know, when the House is in session and we have votes, I'm often, you know, I like taking in-person meetings. Those are most of the meetings I'm taking throughout the day. So it's kind of easier to flow with my schedule. But when we're out of session, and the member isn't here and it's a little less busy, that's usually when I try to schedule my Zoom and my phone calls to do, you know, maybe I'll do a few of them in a row. So really, I think, you know, as long as you're still conveying kind of the same information I talked about, I wouldn't worry too much on whether you're up, you know, up here or back down in Florida. But I do know, yes, like if you are able to come up here, that is always a plus, right? Being able to do an in-person meeting because it does, you know, create that a little more of a personal connection, right, than the Zoom. But once again, as far as, you know, trying to relay information and getting in a request and, you know, making office sure they know, you know, what your legislative request is, that, like, doing that is perfectly fine over the Zoom platform or other kind of, you know, virtual platforms. I hope that answered your question. And that's going to vary a lot between offices. I know I'm sure some offices, you know, may like Zoom. Other offices may be, you know, more in person, but most offices usually do kind of a hybrid as far as what they're scheduling. But that is the one of the good things that did come out of the pandemic as far as, you know, having that versatility of, you know, a video call. I know it was in the past, but since more people got used to that, you know, I think you see more offices doing both, which once again helps a lot of folks that may not be able to make it up to DC to advocate. So don't be afraid to request either, but I will just preface that it may, depending on what you're requesting, may change the dates, you know, or when you may be able to get it scheduled.
Stacia, can you go to the next question, please?
All righty. Kevin, hey, thanks so much. This is Russ Davis, and I know Kevin is thinking, wait, what is Russ doing at a Florida council meeting? He said, I think I see him with the other group. But hey, that just leads back to that whole world of partnership and collaboration and common concern, Kevin. Like we said, a lot of the bills, that several bills we brought to you this year in the first of the year when you and I met, you got to see the very same bills a couple months later when the Florida Council came up. So that was pretty neat. What I thought I would ask you real quickly is perhaps this leads to my thoughts of patience, that we in our community would love for a bill to get introduced in the first month of the new session, maybe first month of the year, January. And by March, it's already passed, and it's passed the president's desk, and it's already law. That didn't happen too often. So we wait, and we work, and we work, and we wait, and we hope, and we pray. And it's not necessarily because it's not a good bill because other challenges impact the length of time that a good bill would take to pass. Can you talk about the challenges that Congress as a whole and your boss and you face when you get, I don't even know what the number is anymore, Kevin, 7,000 plus bills a year running across your desk, and try to figure out which ones you're going to sign on to and co-sponsor or lead sponsor, and maybe give us a little encouragement about be patient, but good things come to those who wait.
Great question, Ross. It's always good to hear from you. I thought that was you during your first question. But yeah, I'll start with, so talking about introducing the bill. So to the first part of your question about, you're trying to get a bill dropped on kind of the first month of the new Congress, right? And so something that you have to think about is when you go into a new Congress, something that offices, the lead sponsors of these bills, I want to try to do is how do we make changes to the bill before we reintroduce it in order to try to advance? How do we get that next, 20 co-sponsors that weren't on it last Congress? How do we get it to a place where the committee is willing to mark it up? How do we get the bill to a place where committee, members of the committee of jurisdiction are willing to co-sponsor the bill? So that is often something that may take some time. Some bills can be a quick turnaround, one or two tweaks, reintroduce it. Some bills are more, messaging, and they may not be something that, is you're trying to make a direct change. But for a lot of your bills, you guys are advocating for changes, that would directly benefit folks and increase accessibility, right? So it may take time for, the folks at the American Council of the Blind to work with offices, right, to try to say, like, how do we make some changes, to tweak this bill in order to make to allow it to take that step forward? And that may take a couple months. I know, bills that we've worked on that we ran for multiple Congresses, sometimes it takes, 3 or 4 months, between an old Congress and a new Congress to try to change a bill, to try to take that next step. And that then goes into your next question about, remaining patient, the time, and things like that, right? So part of it is, coalition building is how do you build a strong coalition both off the Hill and on the Hill, right, to advocate for your bill, which is important. I know that can often be, time constraining when you're trying to deal with multiple different associations, right? Multiple different industries to try to get to some kind of compromise that can try to get through the legislator. So that takes time, as well as time trying to work with the committee of jurisdiction as far as, how can this bill, how can we write this bill in a way that it can be bipartisan, it can receive a bipartisan markup, and it can get to the floor, hopefully under suspension. When people, think about Congress, you think about Republicans versus Democrats and what's being passed under a rule, when really, probably 90% of the things we pass here in Congress are under suspension of the rules. They're bipartisan efforts. They usually vote on them on a Monday or a Tuesday when they fly in. And those are those kind of changes that, that get done. But trying to get to that place can be the hard part, right? And that's when the patience comes in the coalition building. Because you may have a committee of jurisdiction and they have hundreds of bills with, members with all different priorities, both on the committee and off the committee. So it's trying to find the time. And then all different types of bills, you have, your roadblocks. I know if you're trying to do a bill that involves, taxes, right, you're going to need some kind of pay for in order to bring it to the floor. And so the question is, how are you paying for the program? Same as under discretionary spending, right? If you're doing an authorization bill that includes a discretionary authorization, that would still be appropriated, right? That's another thing to think about is, is the climate here to be able to pass something like this? And then a lot of the bills, you know, may not involve, you know, federal funding and are more, you know, authorizations to try to fix problems. And for those, it's, you know, trying to bring awareness and trying to make it a priority. That's why I always say that, you know, trying to find folks who are on the committee of jurisdiction, especially going back to those, you know, district connections, those committee connections, and trying to get it to their attention, you know, is very important. You may have bills with, you know, hundreds of co-sponsors that may not still come to the floor, right? But you may have a bill with, you know, a few co-sponsors that is able to make it to the floor. And a lot of it is, you know, the right climate, the right place at the right time in order to try to see it through. And I know that can be very frustrating. And believe me, it's frustrating for us too. But those are some of the things to try to take into consideration, you know, when you're advocating, you know, when you're doing this. The important thing is to continue what you're doing, because if you don't keep, you know, banging the drum on the issue, it unfortunately goes away, right? I always tell people when they come advocate that it's one of the most important things, you know, for the federal legislator, because we often, you know, don't know specific issues, whether it is, you know, and issues like you all may have where we may not experience that, you know, firsthand, right? That's something that you all experience that we do not. If it's something that is niche to a specific industry, that's not something, you know, we think about, something we hear about until people come tell us, right? And so that's why it's important to continue to come, continue to tell them, you know, the problem, you know, what you are looking to do and how it can be fixed. So I know that's may sound like a lot of gibberish, but those are some of the things to think about when you're advocating and when you're trying to formulate requests for Congress.
Thank you so much, Kevin. Seriously, you've done a wonderful job. You became an instant professor, and we appreciate it more than we can say. Let's give Kevin a big round of applause. Thank you so much. Okay, Claire, you're back on again, okay? What I would like for you to do is take a few minutes, because we always go over the legislative imperatives that ACB brings to us to take to Capitol Hill year after year by Zoom or in person. And I'm hoping you can give us like a little bullet update on where each of our 2024 legislative imperatives are.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Debbie, you didn't give me a warning. I could have come with even more information.
I figured you would know this cold.
So at this time, we joked that we had 4.5 imperatives for anybody who participated in the DC Leadership Conference. So I'll start with the 0.5 because it's the most successful. That was the FAA reauthorization bill. And that was basically a bill that has to be reauthorized every 5 years for Congress for the Federal Aviation Administration to do just about everything they do. So some of you, if you didn't go to the leadership conference, you're probably thinking, why do we care about planes? Well, this year, mostly because of Senator Duckworth, but a few others, they implemented quite a few different elements that would promote accessibility and advocacy for the disability community when we fly, because we all know there's a lot of issues when we fly, especially for those of us with guide dogs, but for a whole lot of other reasons like guide assist. I don't know all the specifics because it literally was just voted on 2 days ago. Kevin might know better than me, actually. But the FAA reauthorization was passed, and I was told quite a few of the different elements of disability advocacy and access were implemented. So we should have out, we meaning the national office, should have out some information soon, probably on the Washington Connection, on the different elements that were passed through. But just know that that was a win. The advocacy that you guys did, if you came to D.C., and talked about it, it happened. So that was the big one. The other four have not had a ton of movement. In the Website and Software Applications Accessibility Act, we unfortunately haven't seen much activity, but we'll still call it somewhat of a win because, as I had mentioned previously, The Department of Justice had put out a notice of proposed rulemaking last summer to promulgate regulations for Title II entities for their websites. And the Department of Justice finally, maybe a month ago, maybe a little bit more, put out the Title II regulations. So it's not specifically the legislation we were pushing for, but it's still very much so in the same realm. And so we're excited to see how that will play out. And we're hoping that with the promulgation of the regulations, it'll kind of help to push forward our legislation. We're not going to pull back on the legislation because Title III entities still don't have regulations. And the legislation still has a few other elements that go beyond what regulations would do. So we're going to keep pushing, but we've definitely seen some success in that area. As far as the medical devices, I have not heard any progress on that. Same with the Medicare and Medicaid coverage. Oh my gosh, Debbie, you put me on the spot. Why am I blanking on the last imperative? But unfortunately, we haven't heard much movement. Things had really paused for a while because they have been talking aggressively, understandably so, about appropriations for the budgets for 2025 that had been significantly delayed, as it often is. So unfortunately, I haven't heard much of movement on any of the four of the 4.5 imperatives, but we still have till, you know, the very end of December, first week of January. So I don't want anybody to be discouraged and say stop advocating for them. Please keep making phone calls and doing what you can. But as far as any real push through committee and that kind of thing, we haven't heard anything. We are, we, meaning me, are trying to keep a running list of any new senators or representatives who sign as co-sponsors to the bills, just to see some real movement in those. So if anybody knows of any of their members or senators signing on as co-sponsors to any of the four, please let me know, because we're trying to keep track of that. For
I think the other one, Claire, was the Dental Vision and Hearing Act, right?
That's the one I had mentioned, the Medicare and Medicaid Act. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What was the first one then? Weren't there two?
Yes, there's the medical devices, and then the Medicare and Medicaid was the other one, which is slightly different at Senate versus House perspective. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
Yeah.
Well, Claire, thank you. And thank you for taking the ball out of left field. I just thought you'd live with these imperatives so long.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I
let's give Claire another rousing round of applause. And we're so happy that you're back with us.
Thank
where
you.
We belong. We
Betty,
really are. Yes.
We have one question on the floor.
Okay, but but it's going to have to be one, because I have to be mindful of time and we've got some other things to do.
Thank you so much, Sunisio, again. Claire, could you talk? I know it's not an imperative, but I understand National Office is going to be a little bit more involved with the reauthorization of the Older Americans Act. Could you just talk briefly about that?
As soon as I heard your voice, I had a feeling that was going to be your question. Yes. So the Older Americans Act, the OAA, kind of like the FAA, has to be reauthorized every so many years, and it is due to be reauthorized at the end of September of this year. We're working very closely as we can with Doug Powell and other members of the AAVL affiliate to do what we can. Not too long ago, we sent a letter out with Doug to Rachel Patterson at the White House, who's on the Domestic Policy Council. So we're doing what we can. We're excited but nervous that even though the blind and low vision community should be very much so considered in the Older Americans Act, because as you get older, the more likely you are to lose vision, we're nervous that there won't be as much in the bill that would include our community as there is. So we're working really hard to try to keep that on the forethought. So just as a push, if you guys are talking to any of your state legislatures at the federal level, please bring up the OAA. And if you have any elements that you think should be included, let us know both at the national office and at AAVL so we can continue to bring them up as we do more Hill meetings and things like that. And because we're at least I'm at the end of my time, I'll just put a plug in. Feel free to reach out to me at the national office, cstanley@acb.org or advocacy@acb.org. Thanks.
Thank you again, Claire. Well, as some of you know, earlier in the year, we had a collaborative visit to Tallahassee. And to give you a thumbnail sketch of that, what happened and what we are hoping to happen in the future, what's next on that agenda, I'm happy to call on our good friend and past president of this organization, Mr. Paul Edwards. And Paul, you can stay seated. I'm going to hand you the microphone. Okay. Here you go.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you. One of the things that is exciting for me is that we have begun to work at the state level again. It's been quite a long time since either the American Council of the Blind or the Florida Council of the Blind or NFP of Florida have had meetings with legislators or staffers at the state level in Tallahassee. So one of the things that the Florida Rehab Council did over the last year is promoted a visit that would include all of the constituents involved with services for people who are blind to go up to the legislature to kind of let them know that we were there. There are three or four things that are, I think, important to talk about with regard to that visit. The first thing is, of course, the Rehab Council itself cannot advocate because it is a federally and state-funded entity that is responsible for providing advice to the Division of Blind Services, but it is not an organization which, as itself, can advocate. But the individual members representing organizations and components of interest to people who are blind do have the right to advocate. And it was those individuals we encouraged to come up to Tallahassee. We did not ask legislators for anything this time. What we did instead was to prepare very brief statements on each of our organizations, on the National Federation of Florida, on Blind Veterans, on FASB, on the Florida Council of the Blind, and on the Rehab Council and the Blind Services Foundation. And we saw representatives from every single legislator in Tallahassee. And the intent was to say to them, we are a constituency who you haven't heard from for the last decade. And it's time that you recognize that we're an important constituency. Here's who we are. Here's what some of our issues are. And you'll see us again. Since the meeting that occurred in Tallahassee, the group, which is called the Tallahassee Day Committee, has continued to meet. And our next meeting, in fact, is going to happen on May the 23rd. And we are aiming at doing three things. And then I'm going to shut up and give it back to Debbie. The first of the three things that we're aiming to do is to develop a single combined request that we can take to Tallahassee that is good with the Division of Blind Services, that is good with all of our organizations. The second thing that we intend to do is to go to Tallahassee early next year, not at the time when the session is running full blast, but instead at a time when Senate committees are meeting. The intent is that we're going to be much more likely to be able to get leverage and be heard by legislators if we go sooner. We're also going to be able to be more likely to get what we want if we go there before all the bills that senators and members of the House have the ability to write, which isn't very many, have already been written. And the third thing that I want to say is, in Florida, we're extremely fortunate in that, unlike many other states in this country, the blindness community in this state is all on the same page. We have been fortunate to essentially be able to operate together so that the one thing we can say to anyone at the local or the state level is if you begin to do something that makes people who are blind uncomfortable, you're not going to see one or two organizations involved in serving people who are blind come after you. All of us are coming. And we're very glad of that, because there are very few states in this country where we can say that we are prepared to act as an entity whose primary purpose is to speak for every single blind person from 0 to 100 in this country. And I think that we should be very proud of the degree to which people who are blind and the folks who work with them have been prepared to operate on the same level in Florida. And we're very happy, and that's what we're doing. And we're not going to stop. And hopefully, out of this, by next year's convention, we will actually have something to report that we've been able to get accomplished at the state level. Miss Deborah.
Yeah, here I am. Thank you so much. We have time for one or two questions for Mr. Edwards, if there are any. My gosh, Paul, you were so wonderful. Nobody had a single question. Okay.
They're asleep.
No, they're not. No, they're not. Okay. Before we do our closing remarks, we have two more people that will be speaking to us. And I'm going to give the second one warning because I asked him to be a part of this, but I wasn't very specific on how. So the first person that's going to share a few words and observations with you is Russ Davis, the director of Newsline for Florida. And the second person that's going to share with us some stuff that because we want to get to know you, is our new executive director, Scott Thornhill. So Russ, Stacia, Russ, can you hold up your hand and let Stacia bring you the mic? Thank you.
Easy to remember.
Thank you, Debbie. Good, cool, I can stay seated. I'm a little offended by Paul that he said from 0 to 100, because after my last Washington seminar visit this year, I felt like I was 109. So anybody who went to D.C. for leadership, I know you felt the same way. Wanted just to spend a couple minutes, and thank you, Debbie, for inviting me to grab the mic for a couple of minutes. I'll be waiting for your to tell me that I'm done. So I got to speak last year to members of the Florida Council at the state convention in Maitland. That was exciting. I got to sit on the panel with some pretty cool people, Paul included. We had a great time on the panel. And I talked last year about building relationships. So I think what this year I'll do is avoid that topic. We've touched on that today, how important the relationships are that we build in our efforts in this process, really in any process in your lives. But we certainly have seen great evidence of relationship building and how successful it can be. I was sitting here thinking about the relationships that I have with the people that were speaking. Paul and I are friends. We've been working together on stuff. I'm thrilled to work with Debbie Grubb. I am also a legislative director in Florida, just like for the Federation, just like Debbie is for the council. I have built a good relationship with Kevin Alkenberg. That was pretty neat. With members of not only the NFB in Florida, but also with the FCB. And so I could go on about how important relationship building is, and it just touches so many different areas and opens so many doors and gets so much done. Getting away from that very quickly, what I want to chat about is essentially enthusiasm. And that in order to be involved in the legislative process, you don't have to be a policy wonk. I've always wanted to say that, policy wonk. You don't have to have a master's in political science from Cornell. You don't even have to want to go to Washington. I know that it's great when people do want to go to Washington, and it's great when an affiliate, whether it be the NFB or the Florida Council, the best problem they can have is more people who want to go than they have room on the bus. So when that doesn't happen, it makes folks go like, okay, so where's the excitement level? What do we do to light a fire and let people know what they can do? Well, going to Washington is one way to demonstrate that you have a commitment to the success of these legislative priorities, and you have a real commitment to making the lives of blind people better through the legislative process. You don't have to do all that to be involved. You can be involved in other ways. You can be involved in a way as easy as sending a quick email. In this case, you might send it to Congressman Rutherford's office and say, hey, we'd love your support on this bill. And your email goes into that hopper along with another from Florida. 150 emails? That'll get their attention. Multiply that times our 48 states. Wait, we have more than 48 now? And you can see the effect that it can have. Phone calls also work, that you pick up the phone and in a matter of 2 minutes, you can express your opinion on a particular bill. We had folks calling over the past couple weeks, calling Senator Scott and Senator Marco Rubio's offices when the FAA bill was going through the Senate's doors and they were going to vote on it. Then the moment that it passed the Senate, it pivoted. And we suddenly knew, well, now it's time to contact the House members, in our, especially the ones in your district. If you're a constituent, you have power. You may not know it, but you do have power. So you pick up the phone and you call and you say, hey, I'm calling about the FAA reauthorization bill. Probably helps to have the bill number in front of you so you remember what it is. That's one I just drew a blank on. But it's little things like that. You don't have to give a tremendous amount of effort 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the way that Debbie Grubb does. But my encouragement is to do something, to be involved, even if it's in a small way, because those little efforts are part of a larger effort. And it's the collective that's going to get the job done, to get the bills passed, to make our lives, and I said our, better, no matter what organization you're in. We are all in the blind community together. It's a, you were wondering about the words earlier. Washington Seminar, Claire, is the one that the NFB does the first of the year. And it made me remember back, I wasn't involved back in 1973 when the Federation started what they called the March on Washington. I kind of wish they'd go back and change the name. It was so cool. But we are, if we're all marching together, whether it be in Washington, D.C., or like Paul said, in Tallahassee, even locally, maybe your local chapter can get involved and approach the city council or the school board on an issue that you all agree on. And if you're going to represent your organization, obviously you make sure it's within brand and that it does equate to the mission and the vision of the council, naturally. But my encouragement is just don't lose your passion for getting this done and don't think that you have to lift the world alone. Just a little bit of an effort is going to help a tremendous amount.
Bravo. Thank you, Russ. Give him a nice round of applause. Okay. It is now going to be our honor, and Stacia, if you can run the mic, to hear from our new executive director, Scott Thornhill. I'm so happy that he chose to come to our convention. I'm sure he'll go to many state conventions, but it's always nice when yours is one of the ones he has chosen. So speak to us, Scott. We're anxious to hear what you have to say.
Thank you, Debbie. And Sheila bribed me, so that's fine. I'm kidding. She didn't actually bribe me. And Russ, when this is over, don't rush out. I want to come shake your hand and say hello there in person, so if you don't mind. No, not at all. I love it, the fact that you're here, and you know, so much we hear about NFB and ACB, and occasionally it's true on a national level, but I think the more local you get, the less and less those sometimes those disagreements get. So I'm so glad you're here. And thank you, Claire Stanley, who is fabulous, and I am honored to have her on the ACB team and to be able to work with her, and maybe more honored to work with her guide dog, Tulane, who just apparently adores me. So anyway, and thank you, Kevin. I did want to say, you know, I was going to ask Kevin a question actually before he left, but we didn't have time. Is, you know, there's some, people might call it inside baseball, and I have, you know, a little bit of experience in Washington. I'm certainly not an overall expert about it, but I would just say, you know, there's those building relationships like Russ mentioned, but also understanding where these elected officials find themselves in the Washington hierarchy at times. And so some of them are in leadership, some of them are not. Some of them are ones who will step out on their own and do something when maybe it's not their party wish that they do what they're doing. Others will wait. I've had offices say they needed political cover before they signed on to a letter or co-sponsored a bill and things along those lines. And so you have to be a little bit aware. But one of the things I would suggest is that you also not be afraid when you meet with them. And you may think it's counterintuitive, but don't be afraid to point out who may very well be in opposition to what you're presenting. Because when you educate the staff, especially, they don't want to go to the boss and be, you know, blindsided, for example, by there being opposition to what you're talking about that's not presented to the boss. And so I think when you can present, hey, you may hear something in opposition to this, and this is what we think about what you're going to hear, is that it may have validity, it may not have validity. But when you're willing to give both sides of the issue, again, you may think it's counterintuitive, why would we talk about the opposition? Because then you're educating them, and the next time an issue comes up, you're going to be considered the subject expert, and they're going to come back to you because they know that you are dealing in good faith, that you're not just trying to get what you want and not telling them where they might take political fire for a particular decision. For example, we've had it with 14C, as some of you may know, with people being paid less than minimum wage for work that's done. When they have an organization in their district who is dealing with people in the IDD community, and they're getting pushback about getting rid of 14C, and not having their certificates for people to be paid less than minimum wage, right? They're going to get pushback from other places that want it to stay in place while we might be advocating for it to go away or to not be used anymore. And so if you can sort of present that and be clear about what you're asking for and really address the opposition before the opposition really has a chance to get a foothold. Sometimes I have found that to be a positive thing to do. And also overall for me, I'm looking at Debbie, just so I don't know if you wanted me to get into this, but and Claire and I really have not even talked about this in depth, but the three areas that I'm looking at are really accessibility, employment, and healthcare. Those are the areas where I feel like I've had people say to me recently that they believe that individuals who are blind or with low vision, and I won't go into the detail of how they explain this, but that have passed away over the past, the past 10, 15, maybe 20 years, if it could really be seen as to what was the cause of their death or what diseases they may have been facing, that several of those may have been preventable if they had access to certain medical equipment that was accessible, or if they had access to medications, that just different things, right? And so for me, the healthcare piece is incredibly important, and Claire and I have been working with CVS and with Walgreens and with Athena Health and others, to sort of make sure that that access, and also with testing companies like Quest and LabCorp and others, that you can get the things done that you need to get done. And then, of course, employment is going to affect some people more than others, but to have a level playing field there. And then accessibility touches all of those things and more. So those are the areas I'm looking at. And I think this whole legislative piece, as we look at how Congress works, there can be a frustration, like, why won't you sign on to this letter? All you have to do is say you're in support of this thing. But what we don't always realize is sort of like, I guess it's from Wizard of the Oz, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. Like, we don't always know what's going on you know, in the closed door sessions they're having with the boss, and they're talking about political favors and who's, you vote for this, I'll vote for that, you sign onto this, I'll sign onto that. A lot of those, that horse trading goes on, and we're not aware of it. So we just have to be patient and understand. And I love it when a staff member is honest about that. Like, hey, we're just not going to do what you're asking us to do. I'd rather hear that than spend 6 months trying to get something done that's not going to get done. So look, as we work together as a team, and I, you know, a team as in FCB, a team as in ACB National, and frankly, a team as in NFB, ACB, I like to say all the Bs, you know, all the Bs come together and we can pull in the same direction. I know we won't always do that, but we can find two or three issues where we pull in the same direction. I'm telling you, I think we're unstoppable in terms of that and what it means and how it improves the communities. Because the reality is that more and more people, as they see the capabilities that people who are blind or with low vision have, they can't deny the talent, the skills, the passion that's out there. And so many organizations, so many companies, so many communities are missing out on those talents and those skills by not providing full access. And so I'm excited for us to have it be a win-win situation for all of us involved. So thank you for what you're doing. Thank you to the panel, for Paul, for others involved, and it's been great. Thanks, Deb.
Thank you, Scott, for your candor and your eloquence. Thank you very much. The last thing we're going to do before we call on Miss Sheila for door prizes is, I want to say something to you from my heart about the necessity for us to vote. We must do this. And yes, in Florida, it is very annoying that we don't have electronic ballot return. It is very annoying that as hard as we work on it, it might take us more of a slog up the hill to get it. But I'm going to tell you something. I urge you, unless it is absolutely impossible for you to do so, to get to your polling place, be seen. I can't tell, when my husband was alive, we would go into the polling place with the guide dogs and we'd vote. And you would, you're here to vote. This is wonderful. Can we give the guide dogs stickers? And we said, sure, stick them right on those harnesses, Jack. And so what I'm saying is, how we vote is our own personal decision. So I urge you, whatever your stand is, to be true to it and vote for it. I urge you to take advantage of some of the resources out there to truly educate yourself on candidates and issues before we vote. And I urge you to make yourself seen. If you can operate a TV remote, you can use these accessible voting apparatuses that are in our offices here in the state of Florida. And most supervisors of elections, if you do it before they get busy, okay, which is sooner rather than later, will actually allow you, they've got a mock ballot, you can see the machine, you can vote on it. You know, like my favorite color is orange, blue, or brown, or whatever, you know, that kind of a ballot. So please, 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 if go to the polling place if you absolutely can. If you can't, do the mail-in ballot. I believe with all my heart that we have the right to vote in a way that everyone else votes for. So I'm in favor of having an accessible mail-in ballot. But I can tell you that the rewards and the returns for showing your face, walking in with your cane or your guide dog and saying, I'm here to vote and I want to use the accessible voting machine, and you sit down to that machine and you press those buttons and you submit your ballot and you put it in that bin to be scanned along with everybody else's ballots, I urge you. So again, we support the mail-in ballot. But if you really want to return, if you really want to do something above and beyond, get to the polling place and be seen. We are people, we live, we work, we are in this community, and we are going to vote our consciences. And having said all that, we're going to now call on our, thank you. and having said all that, we're now going to call on our president, Sheila Young, to do something I know you've all been waiting for, and that's door prizes.
We all like door prizes, don't we? So I, again, please give Debbie and her panel and her guest a round of applause. This was a wonderful session, Debbie. Thank you so much. And after this is credentials at 2:45. And then after at 3 o'clock is Democracy Live right here. So thank you, Debbie.
Thank you, Sheila. Thanks, everyone. Blessings and vote.